Hey everybody, this is Tim with TacticsTime.com, and today I have a very special guest with me today, Randy Reynolds from Fort Collins. Welcome, Randy.
Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Oh, pretty good. How are you doing today?
Oh, good. Thanks for joining me here.
Sure.
I've known Randy for a couple years now, and you know, he took over the editor duties of The Informant after I did, and we've talked about that over the years, and Randy gives me a lot of good, valuable feedback on my email newsletters as well, so I really appreciate that, and so glad.
You like pointing out the corrections and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, make me meanie.
Yeah, the way it works is that the people who signed up first are getting the earliest versions of the email, and someone who just signed up today will start off with newsletter one. So Randy's one of my early adopters, as they say in the software and hardware world. So he gets all the buggy versions that most early adopters have to deal with. So would you like to take a minute and kind of introduce yourself, Randy? Tell people about yourself.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Utah, and I started chess there around age 8. I think the first chess book that I read was Bobby Fischer Teaches Chess, which is one of those that's really cool. Like, you know, you go through it halfway, and then you have to flip the book around and read the rest of the little tactical problems like that. And just kind of enjoyed it from there. Played all throughout junior high and high school. And then around college time, through my 20s, I kind of gave up chess for a little bit and just, had to concentrate on life or something like that. And then once I moved up to Colorado in 2000, then I picked chess back up again and went to a lot of the tournaments down in Colorado Springs and other places like that. Got involved with the Colorado State Chess Association as their secretary for several years. And then also did the editorship for the Colorado Chess Informant. And that kept me busy for that for a while. And that's, of course, been handed off now to Fred Spell, I believe. So, and now I'm just kind of, I've been teaching chess a little bit to younger kids. The school that my kids go to, Trout Core Knowledge, I teach a chess club there, and we have about 50 members over at that, and so that keeps me busy on Mondays trying to teach all of them something. And then I have a few just private students that are interested in getting better. So that's kind of where I'm at today for chess, I guess. I don't go to as many tournaments as I probably ought to, considering how much I'm paying each year for USCF dues, but... that's how life goes, I guess, sometimes. You know, you just get busy with other stuff and forget about those little weekends to just go out and play chess. Oh, and plus, my peak rating, my highest rating right now, which is what I'm at right now, is 1798. So really want to get to that Class A threshold and finally get over 1800, but I'm worried to put my rating on the line because I just feel like I've kind of been getting lucky the last few tournaments, and so I like just want to do a real easy tournament where I can just beat a few 1100 people, then get it up above there, then I can have a new floor and fall down to 1600. I don't know.
beat a 1300 in the first round, then withdraw to secure your 1600 floor.
There's a lot of people that sometimes do that. They usually lose their first round or two, but I was told myself never to worry about rating points. They'll come with your chess skill, but I guess sometimes you do get into the game, I guess, so to speak, and you just want to get to that next level there. I've always wanted to be a 2,000, rated player. I'm not sure if I'll ever get to that point because I think I'm hitting my over-the-hill point, not only in age, but chess adeptness too, because don't you have to be like a grandmaster at age 20 to, or else it's
yeah,
never going to happen.
I mean, it sounds like we had a real similar story, because I think I started playing in Colorado around 2000 as well, and I hadn't realized that was kind of when you started playing again as an adult.
And, yeah, that's right.
And you know, both on the informant as well, and I never did anything on the board, but I mean, you certainly have done a lot for chess in Colorado, so you know, that's really great. I mean, and being the secretary, I mean, that's one of those jobs that might sound easy, but it's actually a real pain in the butt. I mean, the way they have it set up here. I mean, do you want to talk a little bit about that for a second?
Yeah. Well, I mean, usually the official secretary role is just to take notes at all the meetings and, you know, typical secretary stuff like that. But they have a couple of other things that, even though other people can volunteer to do that, it's kind of hard to, you know, pry them away from the secretary position sometimes. It's like, first of all, there's the Colorado Tour Point calculations, and then there's the membership database. And I've kind of created a little way so that the two of those things, the membership, you know, updating the membership data and putting together the compiling the Colorado Tour Points, can kind of be integrated into one Microsoft Access database.
Oh, nice.
And so you really need to have both of those things together to be able to get it to calculate the points really well. I know Dean Brown, he did this a year ago, and he did the calculations pretty well on just a Excel spreadsheet, but I think it did take a little bit more time. Here, all I do is just bring up the web page that has the rating results and run this little Perl script that brings everything into the format that I need it to, and then run a couple queries on Access, and it automatically calculates the point. So it's supposed to be a faster way of doing it, but trying to teach somebody else all
right.
the workings of why I did it this way and all the nuances, bugs that I didn't fix yet,
right.
is the tricky part. I'd said this year that I'd fix all those bugs so it would be more user-friendly, but yeah, so far, yeah, the whole life thing still gets in the way, yeah.
Well, that's true of any, you know, homegrown software tool. I mean, I know I've made stuff at work, and then someone else wants to adopt it or start using it, and then, you know, I never really designed it for that. But
right.
But that's really cool. And just for anyone who's not from Colorado that's listening, we have a system here where when you play in certain tournaments, you get points that aren't related to rating points, but basically like participation points. And then at the end of the season, kind of whoever gets the most points wins. And we've had a little bit of controversy here because, you know, some people down in Pueblo or Liz Woods holding these tournaments that are kind of smaller, that aren't your more traditional tournaments, they're in like a coffee shop, and some people are kind of outraged that these tournaments are collecting points. And do you want to give your two cents on that whole topic, Randy, since you're probably the biggest expert in the state on how these points actually work? And, you know,
I don't know, do you want to spend the whole time debating back and forth about it? I'm like, because I know you're on the other side of the fence on this. So.
No, I mean,
yeah.
I just like your opinion. I mean, it's not a debate. I mean, you know.
I know that the number of points that you get from those Pueblo events, they are relatively small compared to a bigger event like the Colorado Open or the Loveland Open that I'll be, you know, holding in a few weeks. And, you know, so you're going to get more points from these two-day events than the little one-day event. You get more points typically the more people that show up to events. So if you have 50, 60 people, you're going to get more than just if 10 show up, even if they are pretty pretty high rated. So, you know, in that respect, I suppose it's not that big a deal, but it does seem to give a little bit of an edge to those that live closer to Pueblo. And there's a good chess community in Colorado Springs, there. So, I mean, that's, you know, it, it works out well for them. But for somebody that's in Fort Collins, like me, then it gets a little bit more difficult to, you know, drive. We figured, I think it was like, 6 hours of driving for 6 hours of chess. So after a while, the ratio, just doesn't work itself out anymore.
Well, I mean, I can certainly see that that perspective. But, yeah, I don't want to get too off topic talking about that. But, yeah, you mentioned the Loveland Open, and I'm planning on playing on that. And my buddy Francisco's coming in from Arizona, and I heard there's some people even coming from Alaska, so it sounds like this is going to be a big event. Do you want to talk a little bit about the Loveland Open?
Yeah, it's going to be – oh, let me make sure I get the dates right for this. I think it's February 11th and 12th. You don't have a calendar with you, Tim, do you?
I think that's right. I'll look on the website real quick.
That's what I'm pretty sure, yes. February 11th and 12th, and it's going to be held at the Larimer County Fairgrounds, which is basically around exit 259 of off of I-25, where basically the Budweiser Event Center is located. And we've been holding this tournament for, got to be getting close to like 40 years, actually. Charles Moore was the one that ran it before me, and he held it at variety of different places, Coin Community Building, and I think it's the old Larimer County Fairgrounds too. But this facility is a really nice one. I seems to be, and get a lot of good compliments about it. We have two sections, an under 1600, and then the open one, so that everybody gets a chance to play their same, you know, strength level generally. And what has surprised me this year is that I've gotten a lot of really early pre-registrants. You know, I've gotten Tim's pre-registration and the two players from Alaska that are going to be coming down. I got theirs yesterday. I've got, you know, we're still a good 2 weeks off or so from 2-3 weeks maybe, from that event. And we are still, I didn't want to have it the week of the Super Bowl, so I'm sure it's 3 weeks off.
Right.
Okay. I've already gotten 11 pre-registers, and usually I'd wait till the week before the event until I finally start getting a few that trickle in,
that's great.
And there. So I'm almost worried I'm going to run out of space, but I'll figure out a way to deal with that bridge if I come to it. I'd rather have too many people than not enough, even though worries me that if we have too many people, and people are going to get mad of having to crowd through to a table and stuff like that. But
that's definitely a quality problem with some of the tournaments that are, you know, seeing attendance suffering and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, last year we had 43, I think, that attended.
Mm-hmm.
And this may be a little bit bigger. It's definitely not as big as the ones we had in the probably late 90s, early 2000s, when they used to have like 100 people that came to the Loveland Open. But chess has changed a little bit. We have all this online resources now to play a game of chess basically whenever we want on the internet or email, ways like that. So, you know, it's a different chess landscape that over-the-board chess has kind of changed a little bit. But
right.
Still, this is a good indication of getting good 40, 50 people each year to this event. So,
well, talking about people pre-registering early, you know, I sent out a survey last month, and one of the questions was, like, what's your biggest frustration about chess? And one of the things that people told me was, like, you know, I don't have time to play or something like that. And for me, one thing I've that kind of helps me is, you know, if I pick an event like the Loveland Open and say, okay, you know, February 11th and 12th, I'm going to play in this event, and then you write it on your calendar, then you just kind of, you know, it's like planning a vacation or something. You know, you just say, okay, this weekend I'm doing that. Then if something later comes up, you say, no, you know, I can't do it. And, you know, you kind of mentally commit yourself and maybe even send in the entry fee and then, you know, kind of, you know.
Yeah, you basically have an appointment for chess, basically.
Right,
you've
yeah.
You've already set
exactly.
aside.
So, I mean.
Yeah, I'm sure that the, you know, if I didn't ever say, okay, I'm going to the Colorado Open, which is always held on the Labor Day weekends, then
right.
I would always find something else to do because it's a nice little three-day weekend around that time.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, that's great. I think it'll be fun. What's the story with the guys coming from Alaska? Do you know? Or?
Yeah, they have some friends here in town, actually. George Voorhees is one of them who he I think lives here in Fort Collins. His son actually went to Trout and he was, you know, he was a good chess player as well. But yeah, George is a good 1900, you know, rated player, and he has those friends in Alaska. And then I don't know how they, you know, kept in touch or where they actually knew each other, unfortunately. I wish I knew the story behind that.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll ask them at the Loveland Open, but
sure.
And then I think there's a couple other friends too with the same group, like I think Michael Ingles is one of them, and I want to say there's a fifth one, but I can't remember the fifth person's name. So I'm sorry, fifth person, if you're listening to this.
Yeah, that's okay. I was just curious. I mean, because that's a far way to travel, so I mean, I think.
Oh yeah, it is. Cool. But yeah, they like to get around, you know, get down to this area, and it was one of the guys up there that wanted me to move it back to the February, the second weekend in February. I used to have it last weekend in January, just because, well, mostly because sometimes the second weekend in February falls on Valentine's Day, and
right.
A lot of people that are either married or, you know, have in a relationship like that, then they can't exactly tell their girlfriend or spouse, hey, I'm going to be playing chess this time, so why don't we celebrate Valentine's Day on the 16th? Then,
right.
Then the spouse knows they're up to something, you know.
Yeah, right.
So,
oh, cool.
You know, whenever it's falling on the 14th, yeah, I've always tried to avoid that. I know Charles Moore, you know, just had it on the second weekend, come what may, and that caused some consternation, but I like,
well, yeah, and,
you know.
And you don't want to interfere with the Super Bowl either, like you said, because that falls later than it used to.
Yes, and so there's kind of a narrow window. I can do it, yeah, the week after the Super Bowl, or, of course, the week before the Super Bowl, because there's no games playing there, but
right.
That's about it. I want to make sure that whoever's coming, they can still be sports aficionados or however that works, and
right.
Still play chess.
Well, that's cool. Let me ask you a little bit about the teaching kids, because that's one thing I've never really been involved with, and I know you've done quite a lot of that. Do you have any thoughts or comments? I've had a couple people sign up for my newsletter saying, you know, that's the reason they signed up is because they got to teach some kids now, and they themselves may not know that much about chess, so they're looking for help. And do you have any thoughts on that subject?
Yeah, I mean, it's your Tactics Times newsletters are really good, and I actually, you know, most of them I just instantly throw into a little file for Trout Chess Club, so that if Monday morning comes along and I'm still like, oh wow, what am I going to teach them, I can always just grab one of those little files and say, oh, look at that, I can teach them about this tactic that I thought was kind of, you know, kind of interesting. And
mm-hmm.
And so, you know, for a formal group lesson, I typically give them, you know, the first 15 minutes is a lesson where we'll teach about some chess concept, And I'll show them an example of a pin or a fork or stuff like that. I mean, tactics, again, is going to be 95% of what I'm going to be teaching. I definitely have to teach them about the basic check maze, because you'd be surprised how many – in fact, yeah, I volunteer at the Colorado State Scholastic Tournament, as well as some of the local, you know, Poudre School District chess tournaments that they have up here. And so you get to go around and you get to see a lot of different chess players from, you know, younger kids. And you'd be amazed how many of them, you know, they'll wind up with two queens or three queens, and then they won't know what to do with them. And then, right. You know, then somebody calls you to the table and they're like, oh, it looks like checkmate. And then you have to say, well, what piece is giving the check? And they're like, this one. No, that's not right. There's no pieces giving check. And, yeah, of course, it's a stalemate like that.
Oh,
so
gosh, yeah.
That's one of the biggest lessons, I think, that is, you know, difficult to teach, is just being able to show them what the difference is between a checkmate and a stalemate. Because, you know, sometimes the stalemates that are there, you know, where you're stalemating with a king and a queen versus king, it just seems incomprehensible to the student why they should get a tie with this other person,
right,
that doesn't have a queen and they do, you know. But that's,
yeah,
just how the way that chess is. You have to be looking ahead and making sure that there isn't, you know, that whenever there's not a check, that there's some kind of legal move for the king. The other thing that I find when I'm teaching individual students, well, first of all, you got to make sure that you have some kind of lesson, you know, lesson plan, lesson strategy for them before each lesson. And that takes a little bit of extra overhead time to make sure you've prepared something. That's why I always, you know, teach them about chess notation ahead of time and have them record their games, because I can always come up with a lesson about forks or skewers,
right,
or something. But if they have a problem with never castling until move 25, then they probably need to learn about why castling is so important and why your king can get chased all over the place if you don't. But one of the big things that I notice about teaching individual students is that they have a real, you know, tendency of not counting the number of attackers and defenders on a certain square.
Right.
They leave things where they can be taken for free. They'll, you know, they just won't see the threat that there's two pieces attacking this and only one that's defending. So whatever their move is, they probably need to do something that requires them to put another defender on that piece.
Right.
And so a lot of the lessons just kind of revolve around that, just trying to get that kind of mindset into them. And it's the hardest thing to teach. I've even, I should have, you know, checked with this ahead of time, but I even, you know, asked Dan Heisman a little bit. He's a very,
right,
good chess instructor out there in Philadelphia or Pennsylvania.
Right, yeah, I'm a big fan of his, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and, yeah, asked him, you know, what he thought about that, and I would have referenced it if I knew. But, yeah, you just have to kind of go through the same kind of, you know, positions and ask them each time, you know, what kind of threats do you see here, and have them identify that. And it's, you know, it comes with repetition. It's just not the same. When you're an adult, you just kind of see this stuff. Oh, gee, you know,
right,
I know why they did that move. It's obvious that they're trying to put another attacker on my pawn there. But it's,
right,
just somebody, you know, a beginning student will just, you know, see the knight come out and say, oh, they're just getting their knight out. That's something that I was taught was good to do. And,
right,
they'll just go on their merry way and castle or something like that, ignoring the threat. So I think that's one of the trickiest things there are about teaching scholastic students about the game, is just being able to make sure that their pieces are all safe.
Right. So are we talking about children in, like, elementary school? What kind of ages are we talking,
yes,
about here?
Yes, it's typically elementary school. The ones that I'm teaching right now are fifth grader, fourth grader, and second grader, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, and, you know, in the group setting, I've got a group that is just kindergartners through first graders, and it's amazing. They're a group of 16, I think, is how many there are. And you can imagine 16 kindergartners in one room that, you know, it gets really kind of tough to teach. So I outsource that to somebody else, to Biden Gunstrand. No. Well, I do that, but not because I like torturing other, you know, of my parent helpers or anything. I just have to concentrate on, you know, somebody. But yeah, they are really interested in the practicing part, the 45 minutes where you get to play somebody else, but
right.
Not so much about, you know, learning about chess. I think they think that, you know, they kind of know it all around. I know how all the pieces move, so I know everything about chess. And
right.
The tricky part is trying to explain to them, no, you don't know everything about chess. This is why I beat you in 12 moves or something, you know.
Right. And, I mean, I think, you know, that's something I write about in the newsletters. You know, I call it the, like, I already know that mechanism that, you know, and I think adults have it just as bad, if not worse than kids, where, like, you know, you see a knight fork and then you say, like, okay, I know what a knight fork is, but then you go and you play a game and you miss that same knight fork. So, you know, it's like, well, you don't really know it. I mean, that,
I mean, I'll go through Silman's How to Recess Your Chess, and I'm looking through this, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I understand that, you know, knights are better than bishops in this situation, and open positions, and bishops are better than knights. But, of course, in my games, then, I mean, I'll be like, wait, what am I doing with the two bishops? This is great that I have the bishop pair, but all the pawns are all locked up in the middle of the board, so this is bad. Both my bishops are bad. How did that happen?
Right. And I mean, talking about Dan Heisman, he wrote an article I really like where it's called The Most Important Tactic, and what he considers the most important tactic is what you said is counting, you know, and just, okay, this is attacked three times and defended twice, so I can take it, or, you know, vice versa. And, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, haven't really mastered that skill where it's just, you know, it's a real easy mental trick to do. You can just kind of count the pieces attacking and defending instead of, you know, mentally juggling, okay, he goes here, I go there, you go here, I go here, you know. And I think it's a, you know, it's something you don't hear a lot of people talking about, but it's really important to know.
Yeah, it's just so much easier to know about, you know, three attackers, two defenders, just like the square of the pawn. You can calculate, okay, my pawn goes here and then the king goes here. Is my pawn going to turn into a queen? But if you just look at the square of the pawn, then you say, oh, I got it, you know.
Right, exactly. So finally, you said your ratings at like an all-time high. What would you say is contributed to that? I know you said luck a little bit, but I'm sure it's more than that. I mean, is there anything in particular that?
Well, obviously, you know, the most part of studying that I do is all about tactics. I have one of my favorite chess tactics book is it's an orange reddish book called Chess Tactics for Juniors, I think.
Oh yeah. I like that one, yeah.
I can't remember who wrote
Hayes,
it.
Hayes, right?
Who was it?
Hayes. H-A-Y-E-S.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Lou Hayes, yeah, that's right.
Oh, it's H-A-Y-S. I actually have that book here on my shelf. Yeah, H-A-Y-S, yeah.
Okay, yeah. And, yeah, all he has is just a bunch of tactics. Now, they're sorted by group, and so you can kind of cheat and say,
sure,
and look at the bottom and say, oh, this is a fork, you know, and then look for that. I mean, I can go through the queen sacrifice section really, really fast because the first thing I'm looking at is where to dump off my queen at the earliest convenience. But, you know, no, it is really good. They're mostly just, you know, 1 to 3 move tactics, and I'm getting pretty good at that I'm ready to move on to his other book, which is called Combinational Challenge. But that one, the tactics go all the way up to 8 moves, and I don't know, it hurts my brain about that time there. So I think, you know, going through tactics and being able to see those, being able to teach those to other people and other students seeing things in other, you know, in other games, and after the game's done, you can say, hey, what if, you know, what about this position right here? You know, the post-mortem kibitzing or something where you
right.
ask somebody about that and see if, yeah, that looks right. I mean, I have a few opening books. I'm looking at the, you know, Eric Schiller's little unorthodox chess openings, and
oh, that's
been fun
book,
to just,
yeah.
What's that?
I said that's a fun book.
Yeah, you have a copy of that too, don't you?
Yeah.
And it's been, you know, it's been fun just for, you know, looking at a couple of really unorthodox chess openings at the end. Sometimes, yeah, I do get surprised on openings. I'm used to playing through, you know, a dozen moves of the Carol Khan, and then suddenly Robert Ramirez throws out something on move two, and I'm like, I'm not in Kansas anymore.
Right. That unorthodox openings book, that book I would say probably, like, I've done the most, like, laughing out loud of any chess book I've read. I mean, it's really amusing. It was really amusing for me to read. I mean, because some of the openings, I mean, they're really, really bad, you know, but...
Yes, I know.
But it's fun. I mean, I enjoyed it, you know. I enjoyed that book. I mean,
I think it got slammed
by some of the critics, but, you know, I liked it.
Right. I have some more normal, you know, chess opening books, too. But even those, you know, I get to a point where it's like, in fact, yeah, this is an interesting story. You know, I kind of like playing the Max Lange attack, because there's a lot of neat little traps in it that somebody that hasn't studied up on it, you know, could fall into.
Uh-huh.
And I was playing James Kobaki in the Cheyenne Open, I think, about a year ago.
Uh-huh.
And basically, after playing E4, I was expecting him to just go into Sicilian mode, and then I got to start thinking for myself again and figure out what I want to play against that. Anyway, he plays E5, and, yeah, we basically go right into that pet line. But the problem is he doesn't fall for any of the traps there. He's obviously studied it well enough on the defensive end and knows what to expect, where his queen goes. And
mm-hmm.
eventually – what's that?
Oh, I just said mm-hmm.
Yeah. And eventually we get to the end of the opening as it's presented in my book and probably as far as he's gone. And neither of us really knew what to do at that point. And so basically – we were both behind at this point. I think we both had
right.
like, we were like 1-3 at the tournament. So
right.
I don't remember if it was me or him. I think it was him though. But yeah, he offered me a draw or something, and I was like, you know, I don't even remember where I'm supposed to go from this opening now. So I'll just go ahead and take it. So
that was funny.
Yeah, so we got to, you know, get home a little bit early that day, I guess. Unless I carpooled with someone, I don't know.
Grandmaster draw in the
exactly, because we're not contingent for any prize money, so we just figured out what the heck, let's just call this good. We played the opening really well, and then we weren't sure who had the advantage, so we'll call it good. So yeah, that's the problem. You know, you can memorize
right.
all these great lines and hope they, you know, fall into your sneaky little trap that you know is on move 8, but if they don't,
right.
And you're suddenly like, oh, wow, now I got to rely on my tactics. And, gee,
right.
I really wish I would have read that Lou Hayes book or signed
right.
up for Tim's little newsletter
right.
For that now. So it really comes down to tactics. But I have been saved by a good understanding of endgames, too. That's really my favorite part.
Mm-hmm.
of the chess game. And because if you know, okay, I can trade these down, and yes, I know with absolute certainty I can win this end game with king and pawns, then it
right.
becomes easy to decide whether to trade off those rooks or not. But even in end games, there's a lot of tricky positions where you look at a position and it says, you know, white to move and draw or something. You're like, no, that's clearly a loss. What are you talking about? And then you read it through, and they do some kind of crazy endgame voodoo magic, and
right.
you're like, wow, okay, well, if I ever see that particular position again, then I guess I'll try to remember it. So, but there's a lot of good little rules of thumb just to keep in mind about getting your king active and how to get a passed pawn. And yeah, even, you know, some of the really good chess players, I've played through their games, and I'm just like, wow, how did they, you know, how did they miss the win here? And again, it does come back in effect to end game training as well. So,
right.
But, you know, tactics are still paramount. So, you know, even though I definitely like end games, and, you know, you, if you can find that neat little tactic in the middle game that puts you up the knight or
right.
the rook or the queen, then you don't even have to worry about what's written in the end game tomes.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what De La Maza says, is that basically if you got to an end game, that means you missed a tactic in the middle game, you know. And, you know, I mean, I think he's exaggerating a little bit, but, you know, I think there's probably some truth to that as well.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's usually something that gets missed somewhere down there. If you get to the end game and you put it through Fritz or whatever, and it says every move is, you know, pretty decent, pretty good, you probably just haven't played aggressively enough or something. So
right,
you
yeah, that
force
too.
That imbalance, force the tactics to come out.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Randy. I really enjoyed chatting with you here today. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we go?
No, I'm good. The Broncos are out of the playoffs, so I guess I can't be, you know, putting a shout-out to them anymore. So.
Yeah, I should have done it a week earlier, you know. So. And,
yeah, no, that would have been nice.
And I had jumped back on the Broncos bandwagon for one day, so.
What's the bandwagon this week, anyway?
Probably, I don't know. I like both the Giants and San Francisco, and I dislike both the Patriots and the Ravens, so. Probably,
okay.
You know, I'm rooting for the NFC to win the Super Bowl. I don't really care which one, but what about
yeah,
yourself?
Yeah, so this isn't a root. This isn't a rooting for. This isn't a bandwagon week. It's going to be.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I like both the Giants and San Francisco's story this year, and you know, as a Steeler fan, I have to root against the Ravens, and you know, I'm not a big fan of Belichick, and so what about you? Who are you rooting for this weekend?
Well, I was pretty surprised the 49ers were able to get past the Saints, so I don't know. I kind of like to see them finally get back to prominence after so
yeah.
many years of struggling with their program since, I don't know, Steve Young was the last time they were, like, in, you know, really good shape, I think. Other than that,
yeah.
they've just been struggling with other stuff. So I think as far as, yeah, people, you know, I always go for the underdog, so the
yeah.
team that probably hasn't won the Super Bowl in a while. Wait, have the Ravens won before?
No, they've never won.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm still going with the 49ers, okay?
There you go.
But we'll see what happens. Everyone will chide me after, you know, this weekend, and they listen to this and say, oh,
right.
he was wrong.
Yeah. Right, yeah. So, okay, well, thanks again, Randy.
Yep, no problem.
Okay, we'll talk to you later.
Okay. Bye.
Okay, bye.